And we are live.
Oh, it's a countdown.
All right. Hello, my name is Joshua Gilliland, and I'm one of the founding attorneys of the Legal Geeks. Thank you for joining us today for This is the Law, our in-depth look at The Mandalorian, or as we like to say, The Mandalorian, and have a lot of fun with legal analysis of a Star Wars show that might just be everything I love about this wonderful series. With us today are Thomas Harker, who is an Army JAG officer now in private practice, Gabby Martin, who is helping make the world a better place in the great state of Connecticut, and Megan Hitchcock, who is a trial attorney down in Southern California, who I went to law school with. So we're going to have a lot of fun today, and if you have questions, please type them in. We want to thank Get Vocal and our friends at ForceFest for asking us to participate. ForceFest is doing a lot of good trying to raise money for Make-A-Wish down in Los Angeles. And if you've seen all the good people at the Make-A-Wish Foundation on how they help children who are, you know, in need, suffering, and give them opportunities, it's truly a wonderful experience. And Star Wars fans really know how to help others, because that's the purpose of these stories. It's about doing the right thing, and Make-A-Wish really does that. So let's get into the big legal issues from Mandalorian. So I'm going to bring up our slides, and let's begin. So we're going to talk about custody issues, contract law, tort law, and of course, it's not Star Wars without talking about war crimes. So let's talk about custody of the child. Now, we have the armorer say to the Mandalorian, a foundling is in your care. By creed, until it is of age or reunited with its own kind, you are as its father. This is the way. Well, can the Mandalorian adopt the child and actually be his dad? And in California, the answer would be no, because the parent has to be 10 years older than the adoptive child. And since the infant is 50, that's highly problematic. Sure, if the species ages differently and might not be biologically look like a 50-year-old, he's still 50. And the Mandalorian is not 50, so it's highly problematic. So no, he can't adopt, but there is this thing called guardianship, and there's no requirement on age for being someone's guardian. And we actually did a mock guardianship petition at San Diego Comic Fest in March before everything happened in the before times. And there's a high probability we had the best attended live panel for Star Wars in 2020 because of the before times. But Megan, can you help us understand, you know, what else needs to happen in order for the Mandalorian to be appointed the child's guardian?
Well, to be a child's guardian, it has to be in the best interests of the child. So everything must be in the best interest of the child. the guardian has to be able to take care of the child. Who at Comic-Con or Comic Fest actually was called Lucas. And it looks like that the Mandalorian has the best interests of the child. You know, he's got a bulletproof stroller, and he does want to take care of him. Problem is, he's going to have to take care of him for 400 years or more. That's what he's agreeing to do. So it's a long guardianship, since the child is only 50 at this point. But he does look to be an apt guardian. He can take care of him. He seems to get him fed with frogs and things, or with soup. And he does look like he can take after his best interests. I mean, he does have the bulletproof stroller that follows him around, so he's in good hands.
And to build on that, this sort of hearing would be opposed. And if you want to imagine what an opposition petition would look like, because you had Child Protective Services or the investigating agency actually do a home study and go like, so you have his little bedroom, quotes, by your armory? That, and your job is hunting people down and you freeze them in carbonite? That's a really dangerous job. Now, when you think about the fact that there are space Nazis trying to hunt the child down and harvest his essence or biology or something horrible, you know, you want someone who has the skill set to kill war criminals if they're attacking you. So on that level, there is a certain attraction to having the Mandalorian as the guardian. But we're going to take a deeper look at this as we get into the child endangerment issues. And Gabby, can you help us understand any problems with how to childproof the Razor Crest?
Yeah. First of all, like you said, he does not have the best home care situation, because he is in a closet by a armory. A lot of weapons, a lot of, in and out people, not the most savory of characters. So child endangerment is wanton and reckless conduct that creates a serious bodily injury to a child. So on the other hand, you can have a duty to act and wantingly or recklessly failing to take reasonable steps to alleviate the risk to the child. So the key word here is the wanton and reckless conduct. So is he acting wanton and recklessly by putting him in this closet? Probably not. That may be the only living space. We haven't seen much of the Razor Crest on season one. That may be really the only place for him to sleep. And it is small. It is enough for him. And he does seem to have blankets and such in there. So, you know, maybe relative to a spaceship, that is, you know, the appropriate room area for a small individual. It would also be the person has to also be aware of and consciously disregard any risk to the child, which he does not seem to, except when you get into the episode where he leaves him in the hot vehicle, in the hot Razor Crest on a desert planet. This is not great. This was not his best parenting moment. Only 20 states have laws that make it illegal to leave a child unattended in a vehicle. Charges, depending on the state, can range from a Class A misdemeanor to a felony. And in Florida, you cannot leave a child under the age of 6 unattended or unsupervised in a motor vehicle. So that, obviously, we have a child here that's 50, so that wouldn't apply. But you are putting the health of the child in danger. And clearly, when Baby Yoda stumbles out of the Razor Crest, he appears to be in significant distress that his guardian is not around. So I think you could find that he did leave. He may be guilty of at least a very minor misdemeanor for leaving Baby Yoda unattended in the hot Razor Crest.
Look, as the father of two little girls, I have some spare like baby locks and stuff. It seems like the Razor Crest is the most unsecured ship in the galaxy, other than maybe the Millennium Falcon. Mm-hmm. And so I would happily donate some of those.
Oh, yeah. And as for the closet, Harry Potter lived in a closet until he was 11. So, hey.
Exhibit A, Your Honor.
Character building.
You know, in defense of the Mandalorian, that's a compartment. It's not a closet. So it's like, that's what you have on ships. It's a little birthing stateroom with bunks in it. He's not in a closet. So,
The closet is in the eye of the beholder.
Hell. At least he's not frozen in carbonite. So, Thomas, let's talk about how complicated a profession bounty hunting is. And is it okay for them just to shoot people?
Yeah, so the idea of bounty hunting in Star Wars is, you know, goes all the way back. You know, we knew Han had a bounty on his head in A New Hope. So it's, the concept has been there, but it's very different than concept in the real world. Bounty hunting and the folks that do that, bail bondsmen or bail agents, whatever the state chooses to call them, are tied to just that, the act of bail and the failure to, or the jumping of bail. In other words, somebody that violates the terms of their bail. Bail itself is a concept that goes way, 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 way back, hundreds of years. Originally, you know, we think of bail right now as cash. You know, you put down collateral and you're allowed to go. If you go free before your trial, if you bust the terms of that bail, you forfeit the money or the property, whatever you've put up as collateral. Well, bail used to be people, right? So somebody would vouch for you. You would be the bail. And if bailee didn't show up, you got to hang from the gallows. That all changed in the late 1600s. In England, they passed something called the Habeas Corpus Act, and it allowed money or property to be put up as bail. Fast forward all the way in the United States, it's enshrined in the Constitution. You can't have unreasonable bail. That's under the Eighth Amendment. And then the actual creation of our judiciary system sort of defined, fleshed that idea out a little more. But the idea of actually allowing somebody to pursue, you know, a bailed person, somebody who's jumped bail, that didn't become legal until a Supreme Court case way in the late 1700s. And it's funny that this entire practice, this cottage industry, traces its roots back to this Supreme Court case, albeit in dicta, not in an actual holding, in other words, found that individuals could go out, they could act, you know, pseudo law enforcement is a stretch because that's not what they are, but they could act as an agent of the bail bondsman in order to bring that person back. And so that the idea, and we see that play out in The Mandalorian, we see him accept we see him cycle through and deny or refuse a lot of low bounties for bail jumpers. Grief is putting out puck after puck, bail jumper, bail jumper, bail jumper. That's what bounty hunting is in the United States. And unfortunately, it's not, I think the term bounty hunting is not really used. I think it's the common phrase, like what everybody knows it by, but it differs. Most states don't call them that because that sounds like a little murdery or a little like Star Wars-y. Most states call them bail bondsman agents. It's these sanitized titles that they have. And that's their function. They go out and chase these folks down. And so I like that The Mandalorian has introduced a little bit of that. It's funny that the thing that most resembles our bail system and bounty hunting in the United States is the low dollar. Those are the low dollar bounties that Din Djarin really doesn't want. They're not like worth the pool in the galaxy. And then when we talk about the actual use of force, because what is his favorite catchphrase? I can bring in warm or I can bring in cold. Well, cold doesn't necessarily mean frozen in carbonite. Cold means dead, right? And there's this ingrained ability that is just like seared into Star Wars storytelling going all the way back of a bounty hunter in the Star Wars universe to be able to kill somebody, right? You see it when Greedo confronts Han in the cantina. He's fine to take the dead version of the bounty instead of the alive reward. You see it in Empire Strikes Back and other materials. And certainly you see the Mandalorian consider killing folks in this one. Well, in our legal system, it's virtually unheard of for a bail agent or a real world bounty hunter to be able to kill someone. You always retain the ability to defend yourself, right? So you can use force in self-defense. So if you feel that you are being attacked or something like that, you can use force that's equal to the threat that you face. Deadly force is really restricted. It's only in circumstances where you feel that your life or you're at risk of loss of life or serious bodily injury in most states. And for a bounty hunter to get into that sort of situation, I think it's a little limited. most often what you see is they create the danger, right? The bounty hunter is the one that sort of instigates the conflict, whether it's Boba Fett chasing down Han Solo or Din chasing down, the Mithral in episode one. And when you're the instigator of the violence under the law, you lose your protection. You can't start the fight and then end it with a blaster bolt to the head, or in that one Quarren's case, a door to the torso. So unfortunately for Din, he's going to be really restricted in his use. The interesting thing here is he explicitly doesn't use force to collect the child. He had the ability to kill the child, but chose not to, and in fact saved his life at the end of the first episode there.
And I want to raise with that, because we have IGN at the end of the episode say that, something to the effect of that it was a kill order. Well, that turns IG-11 from bounty hunter to hitman or mercenary, and that's problematic because we don't do that. Mm-hmm. Like we don't have bounty hunters go out and kill people, because that's murder for hire, and that's what the mob does. It's not what we have as our legal system of. Yeah, instead of bringing him in, just bump him off for me. So,
yeah, it is a crime. It is a crime to have a conspiracy to commit murder. Like, that is itself a crime to hire a hitman.
Yeah,
it is the imperial remnant that's hiring. Let's not forget, it is the imperial remnant that's doing the hiring here. So it's not out of character for them to put a kill order on a toddler.
Yeah, I mean, like if they blew up a planet, killing a baby is really, it's tough for them to move up on how to.
That's
be
a
horrible.
Monday, right?
Yeah. After A New Hope, it's really hard for them to do anything more egregious after blowing up a planet with billions of people. But let's move into the issue of contract law. And to break that down, Megan and I are going to. IG-11 and the Mandalorian entering into a contract during a shootout. And this is just fun because it brings back memories of Professor Royer at McGeorge and the wonderful world of contract formation, offer, acceptance, consideration, and performance.
Yeah, we can hear all the lawyers and current law students just cringing over flashbacks to 1L contracts right now. Like, it was heard around the world.
Yeah.
Just like, ah.
There are no peppercorns in this hypothetical, but there is an IG unit. And Megan, do you want to help us understand what was the agreement and whether or not there was mutual assent to all the terms?
Well, Josh, this is actually your topic. Oh.
I'll just keep going. So the answer to that is there was an agreement for splitting the reward, but there was not an agreement about IG-11 getting the reputation credits. And I don't know if that's monetary or like karma points in a role-playing game. Like, that's never really explained on what it is. But that term is never agreed to. This also raises the issue of, can you have a contract with a computer or artificial intelligence? And there's actually been discussions about that legally with stock trading, that there are some AI programs that are created to facilitate stock trading faster than a human could process the ability to go, hey, let's buy oranges because of the, there's going to be a freeze in Florida. I'm just doing the trading places type theme. And that could get interesting on whether or not computers can actually form contracts. So this gets into my issue of droid rights and why I do think IG-11 might be my favorite droid now, but it is something to discuss. Now let's talk about another issue with contracts, and that's terms of payment. And Gabby, you know, we have the Mandalorian get back with all of his bounties, and Griff Carta is changing the terms of payment. Mm-hmm. Is that okay, contractually speaking?
It is not. I should roll that back, and I should give the very traditional lawyer answer, which is it depends. It depends on what they agreed upon, because clearly we see that Mando is a little pissed off when Greef offers him the Imperial credits. And it would depend on what they agreed upon before, because if they agreed on the exact forms of payment and Greef is now changing it, that's a material breach. A form of payment, a term of payment is a material provision of a contract. And so it seems like maybe it was on Mando, if they didn't agree to it, to kind of say, hey, you can't use these Imperial credits, which have been no good for at least a couple years now, you know, that you have to have some form of currency that is good, that is tradable, and not just some, you know, leftovers, right? These Imperial credits seem to have the value of like Monopoly money to Mando. So it really goes to the point that you need to specify in a contract what you're agreeing upon, what terms you're agreeing upon, and especially the payment. If there's multiple forms of payment involved, you see this in international contracts. You know, you'd want to specify over, you know, US dollars versus pounds versus euros, because those have different trading values, right? So they have different amounts based on the value of the dollar and based on stock markets. So you're going to want to clarify that. So it may have been an oversight of Mando, honestly, to not specify that when they originally contracted.
He did a really good Watto impression in refusing to accept those credits, though.
I think that was probably a very deep cut like reference.
Totally intended.
Well, Megan, let's talk about Sanctuary and
the
issue of failing to disclose a material fact, and this material fact being an AT-ST, and there are no Ewoks to kill that thing. So can you walk us through whether it's a breach on the farmer's part to not disclose that fact?
I can. So this is a episode straight out of Magnum PI, where the Mandalorian's asked to provide security services in exchange for logic. So if we have to go back to the formation of their contract, which is, was this contract to provide security services against the Raiders in exchange for lodging? Is that an actual contract? And was that valid? So going to Hawaiian law, a landlord and a tenant may agree to any consideration not otherwise prohibited as law, as rent. So under that, security services are okay. A contract for security services for lodging is valid. However, there may be an issue with it not being in writing. Now, there's the issue of not having them disclose about the ATST. So there are four situations where you have a duty to speak about a material fact. And one of those is it may be directly imposed by statute or other prescriptive law. It may be voluntarily assumed by a contractual undertaking. It may arise as an incident of a relationship between the defendant and the plaintiff, and it may arise as the result of other conduct by the defendant that makes it wrongful for him to remain silent. Here, the elements of concealment are that the defendants must have concealed or suppressed a material fact, meaning that the villagers would have concealed or suppressed a material fact. Yes, they did, but... And were they under a duty to disclose that material fact? Well, probably. The third part of this, though, is did they intentionally conceal it with the intent to defraud Mando? I don't think so. I don't think they did it saying, like, we're going to get him to help us and we're not going to tell him. I think they just were either they unknowingly did it, or they were just clueless, or they didn't intend to defraud him. Also, the Mando would have had to be unaware of the fact that of this fact, and he wouldn't have acted as he did if he'd known. So I think regardless if he'd known about the ATSD or if he didn't, he still would have done the same thing. So I don't think it's an issue of him not being able to act the same way.
His first reaction that I love is like, go find a new planet. There's one ATSD in the world. Exactly. You got to go. It's a big galaxy.
Exactly. So, you know, this did require an immediate contract modification, and it did require him and Cara Dune to change their strategy. But overall, I believe that, you know, while it was a material fact, it was not intentional. So I think it did not go ahead and void the contract.
I don't know that they knew what an ATST was at all. I think there's a good chance that the villagers might have thought it was a big animal. Because when he says the word ATST, they're like, what's an ATST? That's, you're just, like, we're just using our silly names now. You know, like between the red eyes and the paint scheme, you know, it's possible they just thought it was a big beast that had nothing to do with the Raiders.
Yeah.
Totally true.
So this was the equivalent kind of, you know, to the, what was it, Fixer Upper show, when they always stumbled upon some major disaster in the house that neither the homeowners nor the contractors knew about. And, you know, really, if you don't know about something on either party, there really can't be a breach. It's kind of a surprise that comes out of nowhere. So,
well, and it is the way for him to, you know, help. So he was helping. And so he did what he was going to do anyway.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And yes. Now let's talk about what some say are disgusting creatures, but maybe they're just misunderstood. Thomas, is it okay just to
C-3PO drive? Is perhaps the least tolerant droid in the galaxy, at least when it comes to Jawas. But yeah, we just had to mention the word Jawas, and I guarantee you this scene popped into everybody's head. It's playing as I speak. The setup is that our great hero now, well, we don't know that he's a total hero at that point, but Din is escorting the child back. He saved his life from these evil mercenaries, and he comes upon a bluff looking over the Razor Crest, only to find that he's been bested by a small clan of Jawas that has completely disassembled the Razor Crest and is doing a very efficient job of taking those parts, loading them onto the same crawler and leaving. His reaction, we would call that aggressive negotiations, because he pulls out his phased pulse rifle and starts disintegrating them immediately. And so what we have is a use of deadly force to protect property. And I already talked about the use of deadly force to protect yourself. Every state has some form of law that recognizes the ability to defend yourself up to and including with deadly force. But that's not the situation we're in here. If you remember, just play that scene in your head. When the Jawas fire back, he's the one that fired first and blew up one of their counterparts. They're firing wildly with their blasters. They're not coming anywhere near him. They're not posing any sort of deadly threat that would in any way allow him to use deadly force in a legally justifiable way. So really what he's firing that rifle again and again to do is to defend his ship, to get his parts back. And 49 out of the 50 states in the U.S. do not recognize the ability of somebody to use deadly force to protect property. There is one state that does allow the use of deadly force to protect property, and I'll give you like one guess in your brain as to which state that is. It starts with a T and ends with Texas. Texas. Texas.
I was going to agree with Amanda and say my home state.
I was too.
Florida or Texas. Yeah.
If your fan boat or your anaconda is being stolen in Florida, then you can use deadly force. But but Texas allows deadly force to protect movable, physical, like tangible property. So if somebody's stealing your boat, you know, on its trailer, you could do that. But that doesn't help the Mandalorian here, because in a weird quirk of that Texas law, it's got to be at night to be able to do that. And if you remember that scene, it's bright and sunny on Arvala 7 as he opens fire on these Jawas. So it's really legally indefensible for him, even in the great state of Texas, which I guess there are parts of Texas that probably look like Arvala 7 there. But even in that state, the Mandalorian is going to be out of luck. And what you're looking at is murder. Or, you know, some variant of it.
Yeah, it's a disturbing scene. So, yeah. Well, on that note of, you know, we have a scene in the final episode where the Mandalorian's been injured and he doesn't want his helmet taken off in order to be treated. And Gabby, can you talk to us about refusing medical treatment?
Yeah, so he is refusing, when he refuses to take off his helmet, and there's a whole conversation about, you know, the Mandalorians that precedes this scene, about the Mandalorians not being a race of people, that it's a creed, that it's a religion. So basically, when he refuses to take off his helmet, because this is part of his creed, his way of life, he is refusing medical treatment on the grounds of, on religious grounds. And this is something that we've seen, you know, throughout United States jurisprudence. It's been decided. It actually arises, the courts have found that it arises from the right of self-determination. And it's not necessarily a privacy right, and it's obviously nowhere near a, you know, enumerated right in the Constitution, but it is a right, the courts have found, a right of liberty. And it actually arises from the same principles of that gave rise to the concept of medically informed consent. So basically both rely on this idea that you have a right to protect yourself from unwanted touching or undesired touching. So you have this kind of body autonomy. And so you, as a person, whatever your religious beliefs, if your religious beliefs say that you do not need X medical treatment, usually we see this with blood transfusion is the biggest example. The court will look at, for this medical treatment, whether the patient is an adult or minor. If you're a competent adult, you're allowed to refuse medical treatment on the basis of religious grounds, even if the circumstances are dire. It becomes a little more tricky when you're dealing with a child, and especially when parents or guardians are making decisions on behalf of their children. Here, you'll usually see a hospital or doctors take the parents to court to intervene and perform life-saving surgery on the child. The court will look at whether the child needs immediate attention, whether the attention that they need is the medical care they need is remedial or elective, in other words, whether it can be avoided. They'll also look to see if there's an alternative, if there's some way that the religious grounds can be respected and the patient's life be saved. And you see that here in The Mandalorian. You see that IG-11 reminds him that he's not a human. So technically, by IG-11 performing the medical treatment, he's found a way to honor Din's religious beliefs, but also perform the life-saving surgery. So everyone leaves the room. The robot and droid is the only one that sees his face. And so a human has never seen his face, and he's not breaking his religious vows. So it's very, you know, very close to what would happen in real life.
I find it supremely lucky that Holowon Laboratory IG-11 thought enough to put a Bacta application spray into their assassin droid. Like he might. What I like is the idea that IG-11 installed it himself. So if he encountered and shot a bounty that needed to be brought in alive, he could keep it. Yeah, you know, just spray him with a little Bacta and keep him alive just long enough to collect that.
Yeah. I mean, and the Bacta spray is honestly like the the travel Neosporin, like everybody should have the back to spray on them. Like, you don't need the advertisement builds itself. You don't need the giant back to tank. You have the to go travel.
Why dunk yourself when you can take one spray?
I countered. Maybe it was Will who installed that.
That's a good thought.
As part of being a nurse droid. But that's us playing fans as opposed to lawyers. But that's just an idea. Let's talk about the and it's because it hits the big issue of doing the right thing. And that's episode 3, and it's the sin. Because the sin was doing the right thing. And it raises the issue of, was there a duty to rescue the child after the Mandalorian gave the child to the client, you know, the former Imperials, who don't realize that the war's over, or that they're very upset that they lost the revolution and they're still hanging on to their beliefs that their way of life was better. And, you know, you see, this is the only time that you see the child cry in the series, is when the stormtrooper's taking him away. And when it comes to the duty of rescue, generally speaking, there is no duty to rescue. We don't have a hue and cry requirement of, you know, saying like, hey, stop thief, and people have to drop what they're doing and go to somebody's aid. If you see someone drowning, you have no duty to go rescue them. And that's just because it would be a super complicated world if we had that. Well, when you look at what happens in this episode, you can have a duty to rescue if there's a special relationship, and that could be like parent-child, or it can arise when one party is entrusted with the well-being of another individual. Well, if you rescue a kid from a bunch of mercenaries, you know, that arguably starting to create a special relationship because you're caring for that child. And another situation is when you have a custodial relationship to another. Well, you know, when you're caring for an infant, even if it's a 50-year-old infant, you know, you have that custodial type relationship there. There's another theory that it's defense of others. That if you see someone who is in imminent lethal peril, that you can go aid them. And that gets very fact specific. Well, you have, you know, Mando, who is clearly thinking about this because he's asking questions, you know, to the client and then to Greef, you know, like, what do you think they're doing with him? Why are the Imperials here? And it's him getting into his ship and reaching for the lever where, you know, the ball bearing was taken off by the child, and he freezes. And that's pure Star Wars, because it's him realizing this is morally wrong, and I'm going to go save that kid and go kill a bunch of space Nazis. Mm-hmm. And
I think...
Go on.
No, I think too, Josh, I think it's also, there's another theory that's at play, which is the idea that when you put somebody in danger, you have a duty, and you prevent others from rescuing. If you put somebody at risk, it creates a duty to you, if you know about that risk, to save that person. So I think that's part of what he's realizing, is he's left them with these space Nazis, and that may not be a great idea. So he's kind of put him in danger. And I think when he gets back to the ship, he's realizing the danger that he's put him in, and it creates this sense of duty and to rescue him.
Yeah.
Well, and how can you not love this cuddly, like this cuddly little guy? He did save your life, you know, from the mud, horn. And so, I mean, come on, like, how can you not love this little face with those eyes, those little eyes?
Yeah, it's, well,
I like those of us just have the trifecta there.
Yeah. Those of us who argue for the rule of law don't normally say lock and load, but this is one of those situations. Lock and load, save the kid. You know, and good luck arguing to the jury, well, it was wrong for them to kill the war criminals who were going to do experiments on the child. No one's going to go, you're right.
Those poor stormtroopers, they didn't even have a chance.
It's not a sympathetic plaintiff in that situation. Speaking of stormtroopers, let's talk about those war criminals who still have nice, fancy-looking uniforms and apparently didn't know that Jakku happened and that they surrendered. Thomas, being the JAG officer, can you help us understand these issues?
Yeah, so I'll tee this up both with an in-canon like place setting and then sort of the framework. So if you're unaware, right, this is set 5 years after Return of the Jedi. About a year after the Return of the Jedi, you have the Battle of Jakku, backbreaking event for the Galactic Empire. Shortly after Jakku, Mossa Maeda, who you may remember from the prequels, the blue Shagrian who sits alongside the Emperor, he sits proxy Emperor, and in his capacity as the stand-in Emperor, he signs what's called the Galactic Concordance, the peace accord with what's now become the New Republic. That ends all hostilities. It confines the what's left of the Empire to a set of few worlds near the core. They are disarmed or largely disarmed. Any remaining Imperials that continue to take up arms against the New Republic or the galaxy at large are considered criminals writ large. And so that's the environment that you see all of this play out in. And when we talk about war crimes in general, the law of war itself, it seems oxymoronic to say that there's a body of law governing something as chaotic and destructive as war. But the law of war, the law of armed conflict, as it's called, is probably one of the oldest sets of laws, you know, the amalgamations of custodies or customary treaties, international law, those sorts of things that we have in this world. It's a body of law that's evolved over millennia. And the idea is that we want to put a few ground rules in place to try to limit the destruction. And so what you see if you study the law of war, law of armed conflict, is after each destructive conflict that we have, society sort of comes together and agrees upon additional rules to try to limit that sort of destruction that we just came out of. And so when we talk about war crimes in general, that's a phrase that's used all the time in pop culture. It's used here as talking in that bar on Navarro as they're under siege from Moff Gideon. They throw out the word like war criminal. Like, hey, this guy's a war criminal. I thought he was dead. But what that means is he's committed specific crimes, right? And the law of war outlaws certain things. It outlaws things like murder. It outlaws things like the intentional targeting of civilians, torture, mistreatment of prisoners. There's a whole body. Not everything is treated on the same level of seriousness, just like the rest of the law. There are different types of crimes. You know, murder is not quite treated the same as petty larceny. That's not to say there's like war crimes light and war crimes heavy, but you know, something like a genocide is going to be different than slapping a prisoner around. Both are war crimes, but they're just treated sort of categorically different. Here, and this is, which I'll turn it over to the group, we have some real war crime, like war crimey things that they get tossed around for like a very legal term. We hear that Moff Gideon is a member of the ISB, the Imperial Security Bureau. Excuse me. We hear that he was involved in something called the Night of the Thousand Tears and the Great Purge.
War crime. Neither of which sound like very nice events.
No.
Yeah, that's that's going to be Exhibit A to an indictment of. Yeah, you killed kids? What's going on here? So he sounds like a super bad man who, again, is going after Vader's record and killing his own guys. So you interrupt him, you get shot. I don't know if Vader ever did that. He might have been so... Yeah, but not for interrupting. So coming out of hyperspace early, sure. Apologizing for losing the Millennium Falcon... definitely killed somebody there, but not for like, excuse me, Lord Vader, and then choke the dude. Yeah, like.
Well, for disagreeing with him, yes.
I haven't read all the comic, but I don't think that's happened. That said, he's a bad man. So he's definitely putting the imp in Imperial for being able to kill and get what he wants. So if he did genocide with his purge on Mandalore and with the Knight of 1,000 Tears, sounds like it had a high body count. And they ravaged.
At least 1,000.
Yeah. And then they ravaged the countryside for Beskar. So all bad, all bad. So Thomas, if you were going to play Justice Jackson at a war crimes trial, a la Nuremberg, what would your main arguments be?
Well, Exhibit A is that black cape. I mean, you don't wear a black cape like that if you're not a war criminal. Like, you know.
You're going to the Met Gala. Yeah. That's like the only That's two times. Cool. Met Gala or war criminal.
Hey, you could be.
That's right.
Or you're the Phantom of the Empire.
The Phantom of the Empire. You know. He's just still lurking.
Or Severus Snape. He is a kid too. I'm keep bringing a Harry Potter. Sorry. But...
Well, I don't know. So the Empire did a lot of bad things. Wiped out all Alderaan. Enslaved people, entire species like the Wookiees. But I don't know that we know of sort of a categorical genocide like what is suggested with the Mandalorians. I mean, the implication is that they broke the back of these people as a whole. And I understand, you know, it's a creed, not a religion, it's a specific identifying factor. But if we're talking about system and certainly it had people that were considered Mandalorians as well as its moons like Concord Dawn and Concordia. If they were wiping out Mandalorians writ large and in doing so, we're cleansing those planets for lack of a more awful term, I guess. He wouldn't have even had to be pulling the trigger actively on Mandalorians to be front and center for a war crimes trial. Just look in the recent weeks, there's a Nazi former concentration camp prison guard that's on trial or was just convicted recently. And that seems to, every few years they find one and prosecute him. They're all in their 90s, 80s and 90s at this point. But the point being, all of these folks, these former Nazis, just as by way of example, weren't all the masterminds. They weren't at the top of the Third Reich coming up with this awful, dastardly plan. These were lower level folks, but they were involved and they were, a cog in that awful, awful machine. And Moff Gideon, certainly by virtue of his rank, his status, and just the authority that he commands, as well as his position in the ISB, certainly fits the profile of somebody who had a prominent role in that, that genocide. And I think absolutely he would be a high value target for the New Republic to go after, put on trial very publicly, and show to the galaxy that this sort of thing can't, sort of person won't be allowed to go free.
Yeah. And I think it's important to note whatever this, Knight of 1,000 Tears was, and like you said, systematic wiping out of the Mandalorians, falls squarely within the definition of genocide, which is the systematic killing and elimination of a certain group of people. And one of those things is based on religion. And so that's what they did. They wiped out an entire group, a segment of a population, based on their religion or creed. So I think, that he's immediately guilty of that amongst a handful and a plenty of other things.
Yeah, few bad guys show up and list the war crimes that they've done in order to say, mess with me, I will you.
I'm going to commit some lesser war crimes to make my point.
I don't know if he felt, envy to Tarkin, but I mean, this is, I think, the second Moff that we've seen on screen, and they really have zero patience for anyone being, you know, insolent to them, and no qualms in wiping out mass populations of people. So
let's also not forget that he's wielding, at the end of the final episode of the series, one of the most important cultural artifacts to the Mandalorian people in the Darksaber. So the idea that Moff Gideon is just somebody that's puffed out his chest and is playing bad guy in a vacuum and has just taken advantage of a lack of leadership that's out there is false. He had a central role. He didn't come by that particular weapon with that the sort of significance that's attached to the Darksaber by happenstance.
Yeah, and a question.
Very true.
Are there war crime laws that cover artifacts, relics? Well, yeah, and we actually had a real world example of that when our president threatened to blow up Iranian cultural sites. That would be a war crime, and which was why that was walked back pretty quickly, because we don't do that.
You also had Hobby Lobby got in trouble. They were found to be in possession of a number of Iraqi and Palestinian cultural artifacts. That it's not a war crime for them to have bought it, but it was for folks to whoever stole it in the first place, and they stole it because they took advantage of a combat situation conflict that left the door open to be able to steal an artifact like this. That was one that came in the news recently and prosecuted for stealing stuff in both the Persian Gulf War and in the early 90s and in Operation Iraqi Freedom as we swept into Baghdad. You know, there were circumstances and not widespread ones, but, you know, the U.S. forces would take over a palace, say, you got a lot of ornate stuff in there. You can't just take stuff off the battlefield, even if it's nice, and even if you're the victor. I personally prosecuted an officer that had smuggled some AK-47s out. So it's not always like nice, you know, gilded stuff that gets out and gets people in trouble. It could be very simple things. He's not a soldier anymore because of that. Should clarify that we won.
Good.
And it leads you to believe, like, what other artifacts is Moff Gideon hiding? Because obviously somebody who takes one artifact, especially in his position and as evil as he seems to be, does not seem to be the person that would take just one. So I hope we get a cut of, like, his palace or shrine or hidey hole that he has. And he has, you know, some goodies, some deep cuts.
It'd be like the, you know, with Thrawn in Rebels and the very nice Black Series release that they did a few years ago at San Diego Comic-Con that actually had the Grail in it as well. So, again, lots of deep cuts. But it does raise interesting questions for how are they funded? Like, you don't have nice uniforms, TIE fighters, E-webs, you know, like just lying around, and all those soldiers can't be there because they just believe in the cause, that they still got to be getting a paycheck somehow. They still have to be fed. So, you know, this isn't like the stories of, Japanese soldiers after World War II hanging out in the Philippines and, you know, for 50 years missing their lives because they didn't want to believe that the war was over. This is, they're organized and they're sustaining themselves somehow. So it'd be
grief brings up that point. He says, once you cut off their paycheck or their source of money, they'll scatter. And that doesn't, they seem like this might be a vein of Imperials that are particularly, fervent in their belief. Why they weren't part of the Emperor's contingency and why they aren't on their way currently to the unknown regions where the most loyal of the Imperials are hiding, I don't know. It's also possible, we saw in the first Darth Vader comic where Vader, to finance his own sort of secret plans, was actively going after criminal organizations and stealing their money. That could be a situation where he's operating on the fringes of the galaxy and he's just stealing from other bad guys, paying his books and keeping them happy.
Yeah, that they're pirates, but they should be, again, it's very, it'll be interesting to see if they explore that. Because on one level, you know, the view of that would be, say, the Colossus and Resistance, that that was a thriving economy ecosystem, as opposed to something that's just guys on a deserted island, not aware that the war's over. They clearly know that there's been a concordance and they're still fighting. And I don't know if that makes it like the Confederates who went to South America to live out the rest of their lives, upset that they couldn't own slaves anymore. Traitors. So,
I mean, maybe they're, to throw a divisive opinion in there, maybe they're related to Palpatine. Maybe this was all his plan. I'm just gonna like throw that one in there.
That's very possible considering their target.
Yep. Gideon clearly knows the importance of the child, probably because he knew of the Jedi, because again, that wasn't a secret. He had to know of Yoda and know the importance of someone of a member of that species being powerful in the Force. So we still don't know what his ultimate end game is. But we can assume it's not good. And but again, wonderful issues. So we have just a couple minutes left. I did share the link that has the video to the mock guardianship hearing that Judge Emily Spears presided over, and multiple law students argued, and it was glorious. Yes, it was absolutely a riot.
It's very nice.
And there was.
It's important to know it was before COVID. It was way before. So
last weekend.
It's been 84 years.
Yeah, so we went out with a bang. So yeah, we San Diego Comic Fest was over the weekend of March 8th, and so and it was just right after that that the lockdown began. So we
just made it.
Yeah, just made it. So are there any other questions that people might have for us? Now, while people might be typing in, we do have podcasts on each episode that Gabby, Thomas, and I recorded. And in-depth analysis, like law school type, exam worthy. On our YouTube channel, we also have the did with CP3O and R2D2 suing the cantina for discrimination, and also the court martial for Poe Dameron, which, yes, that was tons of fun.
Another awesome one.
And so, yes, so is the Bounty Hunter Code a legal document? You know, I didn't, that's in my Amazon wish list. I need to actually buy that and actually take a look at it. So,
you mean the Bondsman Guild Protocol? Subparagraph 13.
It might be professional standards. It might not be a legal document, but it could be, you know, required for licensing. So we'll
might be an employee handbook.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. Mm-hmm. I got the Imperial one. There's lots of good stuff in there. But yeah, I'll definitely we'll get that before season two drops. So with that, we are just about out of time, and I want to thank everyone for attending. I want to thank the folks at Force Fest who've worked so hard to put this together, and yeah, we all have one now. And to donate to Make a Wish to help those in need have positive experiences. So with that, thank you all. We've been doing, we have our own show Friday night at 8, so we're right now covering Lower Decks and legal issues in Lower Decks for those who also like Star Trek. And we are getting ready for a lot more as fall begins and we have TV shows. So,
you want to go around the horn on social media handles?
Great. Gabby, where can people find you on Twitter?
At Gabby the Esquire on Twitter.
Thomas.
This is the most creative handle in the history of Twitter. At Thomas L. Harper. You're welcome.
Being an elderly person over there, Thomas.
My password is password.
Megan, I don't know how active you are on Twitter, but you do have one of.
I don't even know what my handle is on Twitter. I have no idea.
You've got a rare treat with Megan.
You can also follow the Legal Geeks on all social media at the Legal Geeks, and visit us at thelegalgeeks.com. And my personal Twitter is at Bowtie Law, because I wear bow ties when I'm not wearing Star Wars t-shirts. And with that, everyone, thank you. We'll keep the room open for a couple minutes, but we're about to hit the closing ceremony. So I encourage everyone to switch over to the closing ceremonies. Thank you all.
Thanks for coming. Bye.
Adieu.
Bye.